As our top story, Syrian media say the country's air defenses have shot down a number of Israeli missiles in Damascus countryside. Protesters take to the streets of London for the fourth consecutive night to denounce UK police brutality and violence against women. Also this hour, Niger's government says gunmen have killed almost 60 people in attacks near the border with Mali amid violent insurgency in the region. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Our top story, Syrian air defenses have shot down several Israeli missiles over the capital, Damascus. Our correspondent joined us earlier with more on the attack.
At about 10:50 p.m. local time here in Damascus, the residents of the Syrian capital heard sounds of airstrikes and Syria's air defenses, which turned out to be that the Syrian air defenses of the Syrian army are responding to an aggression, an Israeli aggression on southern Syria. Definitely not a surprise, not something new. This is something that has been happening almost every week or two. Israel attacks particular positions for the Syrian army, whether it's in southern Syria, like in Damascus and its countryside, or in Daraa and Quneitra and its countryside, and sometimes in other parts of Syria. Syrian state media confirmed the news, saying that the Syrian army air defenses were able to intercept several enemy missiles, shoot them down before they can reach their targets.
Activist and commentator Paul Larudi says Syria is being targeted because of its opposition to Israeli crimes.
What it's saying is that Israeli planes don't dare to enter Syrian airspace, because what happens to the planes will be what happens to the missiles. They'll get shot down. So they, in order to defend themselves, they shoot their missiles from Lebanon, for example, or the parts of Syria that are occupied by the U.S. NATO military, so that Syrian missiles won't shoot them down. Syria is a sovereign nation that pursues its own foreign policy and economic policy too, and Syria stands up for justice and opposes the occupation of Palestinian and Syrian lands, and a bit of Lebanese lands as well. But it opposes the aggression of Israel, and it opposes the injustice of a racist state on their border.
The U.S. and its allies, like Saudi Arabia, have used terrorist mercenaries during the years-long war in Syria. Today, U.S. troops have illegally occupied nearly a third of Syria. The area under their control contains much of Syria's oil and gas. And just recently, the U.S. bombed Syria by order of new President Joe Biden, who has promised to end Washington's forever wars. Yet officials of countries on a war footing like the U.S. are not held accountable, while the First Lady of Syria is investigated for war crimes.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course the attack on Syria. This is, you know, the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, you know, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council. And, you know, it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defense of war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country.
As the war in Syria enters its 11th year, the UK is considering a probe into alleged war crimes by the wife of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. That's right, instead of probing politicians responsible for serious war crimes like former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, Syria's First Lady is now facing such charges.
Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British-Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why the analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, you know, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Plus, American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
Moving on now, British protesters have taken to the streets of London for the fourth consecutive night to denounce violence against women and police brutality in the wake of the murder of Sarah Everard. Protesters gathered outside the British Parliament and the London Police Headquarters. They held signs reading, "Kill the Bill," in reference to a motion that critics say would give police too much power to restrict peaceful protests. The bill would allow police to impose a start and end time for demonstrations, set a noise limit, and shut down protests. The motion is being debated just days after police were criticized for using excessive force during a vigil for Everard, who was kidnapped and killed by an officer. A London police officer has been charged with killing the woman who had disappeared on March the 3rd. Parisians have rallied in the French capital to protest against the security bill that outlaws the dissemination of photos and videos of police officers. Opponents of the security bill demonstrated in front of the Senate, where the controversial draft law designed to protect law enforcement officers during operations was being debated. They said the move will hamper the work of journalists, violate freedom of expression, and restrict publicizing police brutality. The bill, which was passed by the National Assembly in November of 2020, intends to criminalize the display and distribution of images of police officers which are deemed harmful to the force. On Tuesday, Catalonia's pro-independence lawmakers have filed an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders in the Spanish Congress in an attempt to end the political crisis. Spain's ruling socialists have rejected the proposal out of hand. Cusay Kedri has more.
An amnesty bill for Catalonia's jailed leaders was put before Spain's Congress of Deputies on Tuesday to end the political crisis in the northeastern region. The bill was filed by lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Cusay Kedri, Barcelona.
And now 58 people have been killed in what the Niger's government has called barbarous attacks near the country's border with Mali. A number of vehicles were burned or seized in the attacks. The raids took place in the Tillaberi region. It's a flashpoint area where the frontiers of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali converge. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks. The government announced 3 days of national mourning. From Wednesday, Niger's officials also called for greater vigilance from the population and reaffirmed their determination to pursue the fight against criminality in all its forms. Violent insurgency in the region has left hundreds of people dead and led to the displacement of many more. Several European countries have logged new coronavirus infections and related fatalities as the continent struggles with the disease and its mutations. Italy reported over 20,000 new infections, well above its previous day figure. That brings the country's total caseload to over 3.2 million. The daily death toll also rose by 502 to more than 103,000. The country has the second highest death toll in Europe after Britain. France also logged 408 more deaths and nearly 30,000 new infection cases. and the UK registered over 5,000 daily cases and 110 deaths. The country's death toll is now approaching 126,000. Brazil has recorded its deadliest day of the COVID-19 pandemic so far as the country's health crisis deepens. More than 2,800 people died, unfortunately, from the coronavirus only on Tuesday, pushing Brazil's official death toll to over 282,000. Cases also surpassed 11.6 million after almost 84,000 people tested positive for the disease. Brazil is the second worst-hit nation in the world after the U.S. in terms of both infections and fatalities. The U.S. has registered almost 537,000 deaths out of more than 29.5 million cases. Foreign affairs analyst José Careno Figueras believes Latin American governments are to blame for the large number of coronavirus deaths and cases in the region. Take a listen.
Obviously, in the three countries for the last year, the problem has been the leadership in both in the United States with Donald Trump, in Brazil with Jair Bolsonaro, and in Mexico with Mr. López Obrador. The problem has been that they are skeptical, that they had been skeptical about the pandemic from the beginning, and when they reacted, it was late. To put it mildly, they were very negative about the use of masks. They were very hesitant about dictating or ordering the healthy distance and other measurements. So when they reacted, the problem had escalated and was almost unstoppable.
Eight people have been killed and one person has been injured in three shootings in the U.S. state of Georgia. Two of the shootings were at Spas across the street from each other in northeast Atlanta, and the other was in Cherokee County. Authorities in Atlanta are investigating whether the shootings are connected. A suspect has been taken into custody in the Cherokee County, but officials say the motive behind the attacks is still unclear. U.S. intelligence agencies say Iran and Russia tried to meddle in the 2020 American presidential election. In a joint report, the U.S. Departments of Homeland Security and Justice accused Tehran and Moscow of targeting multiple critical sectors. A report said Russian and Iranian government-affiliated actors also, quote, materially impacted the security of networks associated with American political organizations, candidates, and campaigns. The report added, however, that the alleged attempts did not affect the integrity of the election. Both Iran and Moscow have denied such allegations. Political scientist Wilmer Leon believes the U.S. is leveling unfounded claims of election meddling against Iran and Russia, while Washington carries a history of interfering in the affairs of other nations.
In the report, they say that influence is done all the time, and that is true. There's not a government on the planet that does not do that. But what about coup d'etats? What about the United States trying to overthrow Nicolas Maduro? What about the United States backed coup in Bolivia? What about what's going on in Guatemala right now? The United States is trying to overthrow the Assad government in Syria. The United States overthrew the government in Libya. The United States overthrew the government in Iraq. So, need I go on? So, this makes no sense. It is senseless. There are a number of different political entities within the country that are using this narrative to promote their own interests and causes.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Unfortunately, vendors hired by the U.S. Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, to dispense the first two coronavirus payments to those without bank or credit union accounts failed to deliver. We'll prepare for you an article written by Barbara G. Ellis. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Stimulus Payments Big Delivery Snuffers Needs to Be Addressed Now." The article was published by the TruthOut.org website. Now that U.S. President Joe Biden has signed the third economic stimulus bill, the American Rescue Plan Act, into law, those administering the distribution of the one-time direct payment of $1,400 at the Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, and their vendors need to ensure the last relief payment does get delivered, even for the hard to reach. This was a significant problem with the $1,200 and $600 payments, mostly to recipients in the lower quartile of the 99%, that is, 33 million American households who need money the most. They are the demographic instantly buying goods and services, paying rent and mortgages, or paying down debts. Unfortunately, vendors hired by the U.S. Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, to dispense the first two payments to those without bank account or credit union accounts failed to deliver. 8 million eligible recipients reportedly didn't get their $1,200 payment last May, indicating many of the same people probably didn't get their $600 payment in late January. U.S. Treasury Department funds certainly were available for those first two payments, $290 billion for the $1,200 payment and $166 billion for the $600 payment. The $456 billion payout was real money, as Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican from Illinois, was wont to say about federal allocations. Small wonder that the first distribution of $1,200 starting in March of 2020 was followed by the Treasury's stunning admission that hundreds of thousands of the checks or prepaid Visa debit cards were unused. This raises the question of whether the Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, and their vendors for this crash project tried hard enough to reach the lower third of the U.S.'s 99%. At least one Treasury spokesperson told CNBC that they and their Internal Revenue Service, IRS, plan to build on lessons learned over the past year. One successful contact method for thousands of the hard-to-reach they seem to have bypassed was well-advertised street sign-ups. The Sanders Committee should ensure they do them for the $1,400 payment. The program's second priority was to feed money to the eligible recipient base. That meant individuals with a gross annual income under $75,000 or couples under $150,000 Couples also were set to receive $500 payments per child under the age of 17. Millions of eligible recipients were in several federal databases that Treasury IRS staff could have used. Tax filings and refund payments, Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, the Railroad Retirement Board, and departments such as Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, Labor, Agriculture, and the Census Bureau. But too many recipients seem to have fallen between the cracks of what should have been a rigorous search despite the short deadline. According to MarketWatch, many of those 8 million Americans probably fell into six categories. The Internal Revenue Service, IRS, claimed it didn't have bank account information on these eligible, even though monthly federal checks were directly deposited. They may have earned more than payment ceilings. Individuals, $75,000. Married couples, $150,000. They were claimed as dependents by others. Creditors directly garnished the bank deposit. A complex immigration situation was involved, and the Internal Revenue Service IRS glitches of sometimes failing to use people's final destination bank. Decades of experience with the public taught the Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service IRS that mistakes and misunderstandings would arise, especially for this vast project. So, the IRS set up a frequently asked question website and two other service sites. Get My Payment for questions on delivery status and payment mode, and the free non-filers for those with low or no income. However, the first two payment deliveries needed far more than websites because deliveries were fraught with far more than glitches. Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service IRS officials had to have begun planning for these distributions as the CARES Act with the stimulus provision was moving through Congress. They knew that this immense project entailed far more than delivering millions of tax refund checks. But they apparently were not about to spend time, spend energy, payroll expense, printing supplies, and their own U.S. debit cards on those lacking bank accounts or credit union accounts, or who don't contribute a penny to tax revenues. Their assignment to distribute those $1,200 payments within a week meant they could only to the nearly 90 million Americans with direct deposit or regular checking accounts at banks or credit unions, not the 150 million who lacked those financial credentials, or were among the seemingly hard to find with unknown addresses, or non-tax filers, 10% of the population, or the homeless, 1.5 million Americans. They would be relegated to deliveries by vendors of financial institutions, which all but guaranteed trouble. If found, recipients with known addresses would get snail-mailed prepaid economic impact payment commercial debit cards instead of Treasury checks. The Denver Post reported the U.S. Treasury Department chose debit cards because the department lacked the capacity to print millions of EIP checks required quickly. Plastic cards offered a quicker option. Postage costs would be higher, and deliveries might take a little longer, like late summer or early autumn, because of chaos at the U.S. Postal Service, caused by its Postmaster General. So much for putting money into the hands of the near destitute quickly. warm up public acceptance of this decision, an IRS spokesperson in late April 2020 told the Reuters news agency that, hobbled by budget cuts and obsolete technology, the Internal Revenue Service IRS would otherwise struggle with the enormous workload involved in printing and distributing millions of checks, and could take months to complete the job. Action began on 13th of April, when the U.S. Treasury officials got the go-ahead to sign contracts with three vendors. That is Visa, Fiserv, a Fortune 500 company providing electronic transaction services for financial institutions and which would process and produce Visa cards, and Metabank, a FinTel Technologies subsidiary. Metabank was to be overall and sole financial agent working with the Treasury's Bureau of the Fiscal Service, through which taxpayer billions of dollars would pour into those prepaid Visa debit cards. Metabank, doing business as Meta Financial Group, would direct traffic, starting with getting a Visa use license, as noted on the MetaCard. Fiserv's subsidiary, Money Network Financial, would design and mail the cards attached to a two-page information sheet for recipients about card use and Metabank fees. It also would handle complaints. Major problems began with two vendors almost as soon as the ink was dry on their contracts. The first was the presumption that every American had access to computers, the internet, and to cell phones. Decision makers at the U.S. Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service IRS and the vendors obviously could not conceive targets might not be able to afford computers or internet. But in this low or no income population, 26% don't own a computer, not counting those who never use them. Of those who do have computers, 77 million still lack adequate broadband services for the internet. So how could they possibly find information from the Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service websites or these vendors? Homeless Americans might not have access to computers at all, or electrical outlets to recharge their cell phones for those long waits on robotic responders. How would they contact assistance sources for the whereabouts of their stimulus payments to even activate the Visa debit card? Moreover, most cards have cumbersome and often unfair restrictions and can be lost, stolen, or scammed. Aside from use at banks and credit unions, they are limited to buying goods and services at Visa retail outlets, online or by phone. Money network withdrawals were free only at its in-network ATMs, such as AllPoint, though my card also listed Plus, Interlink, Star, and Metabank. Some ATMs had daily withdrawal limits of $200 to $400. Out-of-network ATMs were charging $2 per transaction. Every EIP debit card, balance check, inquiry by an in-network card issuing bank's ATM inquiry costs 25 cents. A non-network ATM can cost from $2.50 to $2.75. Money Network did provide a locator site for finding an in-network machine within 3 miles of a recipient's home. Retailers providing space for ATMs do so to sell goods and services. Among mine were Walgreens, Safeway, Ed's Deli, and Pietro's Pizza. But once again, what do thousands of recipients do if they don't have access to a computer to find an in-networking ATM?
food for thought.
Hello, everybody. Today, on the eve of the auspicious birthday anniversary of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, we present you a thought-stimulating description about our eventual fate, that is, death. I advise you to adhere to God-wariness, warn you against the difficult days, and show you the signs of God. The feared, that is, death, is about to come, with its frightful arrival, drastic befalling, and horrible taste. It will lap your souls and impede you from acting. As long as you enjoy sound physique and enough time, take the initiative in acting, because you may suffer the sudden visit of death that takes you from the surface of the earth to its inside, from its highest point to the lowest, from its affability to its loneliness, from its ease and light to its gloom, and from its wideness to its narrowness, where the intimate friend cannot be visited, the ill cannot be called on, and the seeker of help cannot be aided.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on the topic of gluttony and eating too much, and we've mentioned this a few times now, by the way, so I don't need to repeat things that I've already discussed, like, for example, excessively eating brings about a hardening of the heart. We've mentioned that there are two things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dislikes. It's been so much mentioned in the hadith that we come to understand that, you know, this really must be something very, very bad in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, where al-na'um, someone who excessively sleeps, al-akul, someone who excessively eats, these people have been pretty much condemned, you know, in the eyes of Islam. What a beautiful hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam.
أذيبوا طعامكم, melt or destroy or get rid of your food بذكر الله والصلاة, which basically means that through dhikrullah subhanahu wa ta'ala and through salah, you're going to be eating less. وَلَا تَنَامُ عَلَيْهَا, and don't sleep while you have food with you, which basically means sleeping with a full stomach. فَتَقْسُوا قُلُوبُكُمْ, or else your hearts will become hardened. And there are so many ahadith that speak in this line. From Nabiullah Isa, from Jesus alayhi salam, إِذَا أَكَلْتْ فَإِيَّاكَ أَن تَشْبَعِينَ, if you eat, then never ever become full. لِأَنَّ الطَّعَامِ إِذَا تَكَاثَرَ عَلَى الصَّدْرِ فَزَادَ فِي الْقَدْرِ ذَهَبَ مَاءُ الْوَاجِهِ, because when you eat too much, it's going to affect your chest, it's going to affect your nafs, it's going to affect your soul. Then your stomach, for example, it's going to become hard, you're going to become heavy, then it's going to remove or ruin or take away your dignity. ذَهَبَ مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, basically, مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, your abru, your مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, pretty much basically means your honor, your dignity, your face value. Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, لَا تَرْفَعْ يَدَكَ مِنَ الطَّعَامِ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ تَشْتَهِي. We know this very frequently mentioned hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, don't remove your hand from the food unless you continue to want it. So when you feel that you still want some more food, you withdraw yourself from eating. فَإِن فَعَلْتَ ذَلِكَ فَأَنْتَ تَسْتَمِرْهُ, and if you were to do so, then you will still feel that ladha, that passion, that pleasure of food.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری و ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون, این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, "Man qalla ta'amuh sahha badana," someone who eats less will have a healthier body. And from Imam al-Baqir, "Ma min shay'in abghad ila Allah 'azza wa jal min batnin mamlu'." Imam al-Baqir says, peace be upon him, he says, there's nothing worse in the eyes of God more than a full stomach. ما من شيء أبغض إلى الله عز وجل من بطن مملوء. So Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is mentioning these hadith one after the other and making sure
that we understand that kind of sequence of what it is that we're leading to, where it all comes down to a person finding that balance, where you're not only taking care of your physical health, your stamina, your natural need of eating, but you're also making sure that you don't become a person who is fixated, is obsessed with only food. And it's a really, really bad characteristic for a person to have. Which is exactly why, you know, we always hear those kind of reminders that, you know, when you look at your food, be thankful. Don't eat something hot. You know, don't waste. These kind of things are drilled in our minds for a purpose, of course. And for us to see food and water as something sacred. And that's why Sheikh Jawadi Amali mentions it again here. He says that the reason why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would sit jalsatul abd, in the seating of a servant, is because he saw food and wanted to show humbleness towards it. Qala, and a hadith was asked, why did he do this? Tawadu'an lillahi azza wa jal, as it says, as the hadith says in Al-Kafi. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
To the light. Let's go to the US, where a baby giraffe has explored his habitat at the Indianapolis Zoo for the first time. In a sunny day, Candy playfully made his first public appearance along with his mother and the herd. The cute calf was born in November and has no siblings yet. Giraffes are native to sub-Saharan Africa, so the zookeepers only allow them to be outside when the weather is not wet or cold. Two tiny islands in South Korea have become tourist attractions by turning almost everything to purple. They are now known as Purple Islands. Banwol and Bakji Islands used to be abandoned locations with small populations of elderly people. But everything changed when residents launched a popular campaign there in 2015. Inspired by their native balloon flower, they started painting the houses, roads and bridges in different shades of purple. They planted more purple flowers on the islands and wore clothes with the same color. Restaurants on the islands also started serving purple food.
We couldn't travel overseas due to COVID-19, so we thought about a local trip instead and found these purple islands. It's amazing and looks like fairy tales and magic. As I'm seeing, the grandmas are all wearing purple clothes. It is very dreamy.
The tourists also praise the welcoming spirit of the islanders, who offer a free entry to the visitors dressed in purple. The campaign has changed the island's ambience, adding liveliness and activity to the routine of its residents. It's also attracted the government support, which has invested more than $4 million to turn the islands purple. World-renowned musician Yo-Yo Ma has transferred a COVID-19 vaccine waiting room to a concert hall in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh. played the pieces after receiving a second dose of the coronavirus jab. Dozens of socially distanced people who had just received their second shot listened on at the Berkshire Community College while waiting for the 15-minute mandatory observation period to end. Yo-Yo Ma, who is a local resident, has said this performance was meant to give something back to the community.
Rations in the town of Yaryapolsky mark the end of winter with a colorful Maslenitsa celebration. People dressed in costumes march in the center of the town, which lies some 170 kilometers from Moscow. After some friendly competitions, participants burn the effigy of Maslenitsa. This marks the end of winter and was believed to fertilize the soil and bring a good harvest in the upcoming autumn.
The Maslenitsa went great. We have been sitting at home for a long time because of this COVID, but now everything is fine.
Maslenitsa is celebrated during the last week before the Christian festival of Lent. It is a last chance to the upcoming weeks to eat dairies and meat, which are forbidden in the upcoming fasting time. The festival began as a pagan ritual, but was later absorbed into the Russian Orthodox Christian tradition.
Now, the first gorilla born in the Berlin Zoo in 16 years finally has a name. The naming day was celebrated with no visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, zookeepers made the day special for the tiny Tira and her first-time mother with their favorite treats. The baby was born in mid-February. After a few weeks, the zoo received over 17,000 name suggestions for her. The low number of female firefighters across the world may indicate women's lack of interest in the job, but this female-only Brazilian firefighter crew is here to prove the opposite. The all-female team say their main goal is to empower women through the work they do. They say they are willing to prove that women can take any job that can help society. The firefighting crew started their activity just on Monday on International Women's Day. They work in southeastern Brazilian state. Although women have a variety of fire service roles in different countries, they account for less than 20% of firefighters worldwide.
In China's commercial hub Shanghai is not only filled up with skyscrapers, but this cosmopolitan city has many incredible things to attract domestic and foreign tourists as well. Unofficial statistics show Shanghai is China's de facto capital of animal cafes, which are growing in terms of numbers and the variety of species that they host. There are now all kinds of animal coffee shops there. One of these venues is filled with cute furry raccoons, which sometimes tug at customers' clothes while they are served their food. In another cafe, clients can enjoy the company of outlandish reptiles as they sip hot drinks. Those who frequent these bistros say the activity helps them relax and forget the hustle and bustle of city life. An advert showcasing a bowling alley has become an instant hit online by combining expert drone flying techniques and impressive filmmaking skills. The 90-second-long one-take video is titled Right Up Our Alley. The journey begins with a drone flying over the Blind Lake Bowl in the U.S. city of Minneapolis before swooping inside the venue at a remarkable speed. The device then flies over bowling lanes and small passageways, taking the audience on a tour of the entire facility. The footage ends by the drone crashing into the bowling pegs. The video has already racked up millions of views online.
Yeah, I think there's some skepticism there of it being a true one take. It is a true one take. There's no CGI. You know, that was kind of interesting, but also the positive nature of it, of people seeing the skill that it takes and the unique ability to like combine the skill of an amazing pilot, the technology of the drone, and the story that, thank you, the story that actually can be told through a one take.
The footage was shot by a quadcopter drone. It took the pilot and the director about 10 to 12 attempts over 2 hours to produce the perfect take. The filmmakers undertook the project free of charge. Their aim was to help local businesses recover from the coronavirus-related losses.
A Swedish scuba diver is using his skills to clean up the underwater environment.
My name is Fredrik Johansson, and 2 years ago, I started up a project called Rena Malarin. We have two goals. One is to get a lot of toxic waste up from the water, and the other thing is to make people aware of this planet and to do better.
A number of Swedish scuba divers have voluntarily joined Johansson's program. They pull out harmful waste and trash from waterways and lakes. Johansson says he is shocked by the number of polluting fragments discovered in the Swedish marine environment. He says one of the main polluting factors is lead batteries discarded from boats. He says many waterways in the capital Stockholm are littered with these used batteries.
A new study has revealed a sad fact. Humans have destroyed around two-thirds of the world's tropical rainforests. According to a report by Rainforest Foundation Norway, logging and land conversion has ruined 34% of tropical rainforests. They have also caused degradation of another 30%, which makes the forest more vulnerable to fire and destruction. The report says that since 2002, over half of the vanishing has occurred in South America's Amazon. Experts believe the loss of tropical forests makes climate change worse. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the 7th consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release 4 other cute turtles.